You're listening to episode 377 of New World Order. My name is Klaatu, and in this episode, we're going to be talking about Fedora Silver. Fedora Silver Blue is a distribution. You might think at first that it's a spin of a Fedora, but actually a spin or a remake would be taking the Fedora image and applying, for instance, a new desktop to it, or a specific set of packages before producing an ISO for people to download. Silverblue is a restructuring of the Fedora distribution. So it is Fedora Linux, but it is packaged and distributed, and it runs in a completely unique fashion from standard Fedora Linux. Specifically, Fedora Silverblue runs with an immutable operating system at its core, and then it uses what I'll briefly call a layer to provide user customization. Now, I'm saying I'm briefly calling it a layer because it's not really a layer. I feel like the layer analogy is used for a lot of different technologies, and it does kind of fit in a way here, but I don't want to suggest that it is something that it is not. What it is more like is a Git repository. If you think of Fedora Silverblue, and again, this isn't exactly correct, but this will get us really close to understanding what's going on. If you think of Fedora Silverblue as an operating system managed by Git, then you are very close to how it structures itself. What's actually happening is it is using a technology called OS Tree, which uses a very Git-like structure in that it has a main branch, or a trunk, you might even say. They don't, but you could say that there's a trunk, and that would be that operating system core that I was talking about, that immutable. That immutable means it cannot be mutated, it's unchangeable. This core operating system component is booted and loaded when you start your computer, and that main branch, that core, represents a state of a repository, of a collection of software. By using this technology called OS Tree, you are able to graft a new branch off of that core, off of that trunk, and that new branch can contain any number of changes. So for instance, you might install some new software. So now that branch has that software loaded into it. Here's a description of this process from the OS Tree man page itself. OS Tree is a tool for managing multiple bootable versioned file system trees, or just tree for short. In the OS Tree model, operating systems no longer live in the physical slash root directory. Instead, they parallel install to the new top level slash OS Tree directory. Each installed system gets its own slash OS Tree slash deploy slash state root directory. State root is the new term for OS name. Unlike RPM or DPKG, OS Tree is only aware of complete file system trees. It has no built-in knowledge of what components went into creating the file system tree. It goes on to say, it is possible to use OS Tree in several modes. The most basic form is to replicate pre-built trees from a build server. Usually these pre-built trees are derived from packages. You might also be using OS Tree underneath a higher level tool, which computes file system trees locally. It must be emphasized that OS Tree only supports read-only trees. To change to a different tree, that is, upgrade or downgrade or install software even, a new tree is checked out and a three-way merge of configuration is performed. The currently running tree is not ever modified. It is immutable. The new tree becomes active upon a system reboot. So this is what they're talking about when they say that the operating system is immutable on Silverblue. You run this image of an operating system. The operating system essentially doesn't know how it got to where it is. It doesn't know that it has had RPMs installed. It doesn't understand. It has no database of packages. It is simply in the state that it is when it is booted up. That's all it really knows. And it doesn't ever change. You can't go in and remove a package that you no longer want on your operating system, or indeed add a package that you feel is necessary. For instance, a video card driver. If you're running an NVIDIA graphics card, which I am on my desktop computer, you can't go in and tell it to add an NVIDIA graphics driver module, because that would need to change that file system image, and there's no way to do that. Now, there's a huge caveat here, and that is, as the man page itself says, in order to change that to upgrade or downgrade or install software, you have to check out a new tree, essentially, perform a merge, and then reboot. Now your image is, well, it's a new image, it is immutable, and that's what you're running. And again, it doesn't know how it got there. It doesn't know that you've added a repository, added an RPM, and then rebooted. All it knows is that it is what it is. Now, this may all seem really, really crazy to you, and indeed, it kind of seems a little bit crazy to me. When I first heard about it, it sounded just crazy enough to maybe be something to look into. I don't know how fresh of an idea this is. I know that there have been other systems, such as Nix OS, and I think even the Geeks system a little bit, GUIX, I think that may share something in relation to this. And I feel a little bit guilty for my first foray into this strange new world of a completely different structure for the Linux file system layout is Fedora Silverblue, because I feel like I've known about the little independent projects working towards this reimagining of how things are structured. I've ignored them, and I've just gone for the big, obvious, mainstream one and skipped all the other ones. And so I feel a little bit strange about having done it this way, but I'll be honest, and my interest in Fedora Silverblue has largely been constrained to the container aspect. And that's really kind of why I felt like it was maybe time to talk about Fedora Silverblue now, because in the previous episodes of GNU World Order, you'll have explored a couple of different tools with me, dear listener. We have talked about NSInter and Unshare, which allowed us to sort of look at and enter the kernel namespaces to which different PIDs have been assigned. We looked at LXC a couple of episodes ago, so that's the Linux Container Project. And a couple of episodes ago as well, we looked at that blog post about cheroot and container technology throughout the ages since, what was it, 1979 or something crazy early like that. So at this point, I feel like, at this point in the GNU World Order, I feel like we're kind of talking about containers, and I've made it as clear as I felt it necessary that containers are a big deal, and that, none of us know where containers are going. We don't know if it's just a fad. We don't know if it's the new model of computing. We're in the middle of it. We can't predict what kind of effect this is actually going to have on anything. But what I can say is that there's a lot of convergence happening here with containers. You've got, for instance, on an Android phone, you don't have containers, but you do have kind of this system of, well, here's the image of the OS, and here's all the different applications that can run on it, and here's a permission structure for those applications to access specific points on the file system. So when you install an app, it may ask you or tell you that in order for it to run, it requires access to your camera or to your photos or whatever, and you must grant it explicit permission to go through that portal and access the data on your SD card. On Linux, of course, you have, these days on the cloud, you've got containers all over the place. On Linux itself, on the desktop, you've got Flatpaks, and Flatpak very, very specifically has a portal structure, an API called the portal system, and it allows you to access, or it allows the developer creating a Flatpak to access things outside of that sandbox that the Flatpak represents. We've talked about Flatpak before, and we know that it is essentially a container. It's the container model, which actually is also, Flatpaks are based on OS Tree as well. So more convergence from different places. We've got Silverblue sort of combining these ideas from containers and OS Tree into a desktop distribution. You've got Kubernetes and OpenShift and things like that on the servers for clouds, creating a distributed computing model that is based largely on ephemeral containers that spin up and spin down as needed, that can access data outside of those containers in order to keep the configurations and the data stores consistent, and so on. So I think Silverblue is kind of interesting to look at, if only because of its because of how it relates to all of these other technologies. And indeed, that is kind of what Silverblue itself pitches itself as. So it says in on there, if you go to fedoraproject.org/en-us/fedora-silverblue, you find its description is Fedora Silverblue is an immutable desktop operating system. It aims to be extremely stable and reliable. It also aims to be an excellent platform for developers and for those using container-focused workflows. So it is aware of its proximity to containers and to that sort of sense that you might be someone who is working with environments, and the environments are not necessarily persistent, but they are on demand. And there are lots of different advantages to that, and I think exploring Silverblue kind of gives you a combination of the advantages and, I won't say disadvantages, but I will say some of the hurdles that you might encounter, or that we're all encountering as we collectively, if I may, as we try to sort of combine these ideas of containers with just normal computing. Because obviously containers are working well for the cloud, right? That model has proven itself. People are quite happy with that. I mean, not everyone universally, but I'm saying the people doing the work on the ground providing the services are saying and have said loud and clear, this container thing is really working for us. And that's why it's taking off. I mean, it's not, containers aren't, they're not happening because of an agenda. They're happening because people have adopted it en masse and are using that technology to scale up, to scale out, to develop quickly, to manage services, to orchestrate these massive distributed services across the world. It's something that's working quite well, and so that's what's happening. It's being used. And I guess the question that we kind of have to ask ourselves is, can whatever benefits the cloud is experiencing from containers, can that be translated in any way over to the desktop experience? And indeed, who knows, maybe eventually to the mobile experience, if convergence of the desktop and mobile experiences ever actually happens. And I know Ubuntu had really given it a go to make that happen. Didn't happen. And I don't know where that, I don't know who's picked up that ball. I mean, I know that a couple of people have, but I mean, I don't know who's really trying to make it happen now. I'm not sure. But whatever we're in store for, I think it's important to kind of to do this thought experiment, except it's not just a thought experiment, it exists in Silverblue, of how do containers pertain to real-life users who just want to get computing done. But before we dive into Silverblue, let's talk a little bit about these potential benefits, why we might want to look at container technology on a desktop when frankly, desktops have been perfectly fine without containers for decades now. And there are a couple of different advantages here. There are three that I can think of. One is portability and autonomy. Two is security. And three is, I'll call it consistency. So the first one, portability and autonomy, would address the issue of, let's say you want to run two different versions of an application on the same system. That can cause problems. On Linux, it can cause problems. There are workarounds. If you're trying to run foo and bar, whereas foo requires libpng12 and bar requires libpng14, that's basically the same library, right, libpng. But you could compile the one that is not the default on your system yourself. You could compile it and name it something specific, like libpng 12, let's say, maybe 14 shipped on your system, so you're compiling this old version that you need for this legacy application with PNG 12. And then you compile the legacy application so that it points specifically to libpng 12, so that there's no confusion. Don't point to libpng 14. I know that you need 12 specifically for some reason. I'm making a lot of these examples up, but they're kind of echoes of experiences that I have had. So you compile it to point very specifically to a specific version that has also been compiled separately. Now, the problem here is, number one, there can still be issues because maybe the BMG 12 has some files that wouldn't get named in any kind of special way, and it might still collide with libpng 14 for whatever reason. Who knows? It could be something simple. It could be something that the make file just doesn't account for. You never know. And in truth, it works fine for libpng, so I probably shouldn't have used that as an example. But some lib out there could have that issue of where there could be a conflict beyond the obvious files that you would be renaming. And if the make file doesn't take that into account, then it could be problematic. And even then, you could probably find a way to link back to a specific location. Well, not probably. You can usually find a way to link back to a specific location and avoid these kinds of issues. But I think the problem as it actually manifests in practice is that people just aren't going to compile those applications. That's just not something that most users are going to want to do for the applications that they may or may not want to run. More typically, people are simply going to install a package as provided by their distribution. I mean, that's kind of the intent. And going outside of that system and doing something wacky just doesn't always, it's not always easy. You can argue that that you shouldn't have to go outside your package manager and do the wacky thing anyway and so on. But in practice, for maximum flexibility, none of this would be an issue, and you would just be able to install this application that requires this version of the library alongside a different version of an application or a different application that requires a different library set. It just shouldn't be an issue at all. It shouldn't be something that you have to think about. And indeed, we've seen operating systems that have solved this problem. We've had it since, I think, Next, which is probably, what, the 90s? Next, of course, is the precursor to Mac OS X at the time, and it has self-contained application directories. We've seen projects take advantage of this. We've seen Rocks Filer on Linux use this concept of an apdir, a directory called .apdir, project name .apdir, and that extension .apdir tells the system, run this thing as if though all the linking has been done internally. Everything that this application needs to run, this executable needs to run, is contained in this folder. It worked pretty well. From what I understand, I've never actually used it myself, but it was essentially re-implemented in app images, which of course we've talked about on this show before. App images, the same idea. There's a folder with some special extension or in some special format. It used to be .iso, now it's some kind of squash.fs thing, and everything inside of that folder, that directory, is supportive of the main executable that needs to run. And so everything is kind of self-contained in a very literal, like, it's very much right there, self-contained sense. Now, Flatpak has taken this concept and blown it out a little bit, expanded it, given it a couple of extra layers, so that rather than saying, okay, well, everything that this Flatpak needs to run is in a specific folder, we have support packages, like little SDKs, as it were. We have these support layers that will install for this group of Flatpaks, and all of those Flatpaks will point back to this release. And so we have a foundation, a standardized foundation upon which all of those applications can then build. And if something's not in that standard foundation, then you can include it in your Flatpak, and that way you don't need anything underneath your Flatpak other than, you know, what you're providing. But if there's something huge and big that you don't want to throw into a Flatpak, that's fine. We probably have that foundation for you. So if, for instance, your application uses, I don't know, the Qt widget set, then we'll install that at the base level, and you can refer back to it in your Flatpak, and rest assured that when anyone installs your Flatpak, they will also be installing the Qt widget set layer, and so on. Autonomy. It's important because no one wants to worry about every little library required for an application. So that's an important one. Security is another one. I'm not going to say too much about this because that's always a moving target anyway, but you get the idea. There's a container. As far as that container knows, it is the only thing that exists in the world. It is a complete system. Of course, it's not actually. It doesn't even have a kernel. It's leeching off of the kernel that's running the container, but as far as it knows, it's a complete system. And so if some exploit takes advantage of the code running inside of that container, well, that exploit can only see as far out as the container walls itself. When it reaches the root layer of your file system or of its file system, it believes that that's the actual root of everything, but it's not. It's just the fake root, or it's the container's root of the file system. So it doesn't have access to important things running on your actual system. All it can do is spoil what's ever inside of that container. And since the container is by design disposable, you should be able to shut down the container and lose no data. It doesn't really matter that the exploit has taken advantage of the container. In theory, like I say, moving target. And then the third and final one, I guess, consistency. And this, I think, applies mostly to people who deal with containers on an everyday basis. And that's what Silverblue's documentation suggests, that they are targeting people who have to deal with these disposable, self-contained environments on an everyday basis. That's their world. That's where they live. They're developing code. They're working inside of these containers. And so to have that same model applied to their desktop, in a way, makes a lot of sense. You can kind of get a flavor for this if you start using Python with Python environments. Python environments are, well, they're little environments. They're really just almost a cheroot in a way, because what it says is that, okay, well, here's a new environment. So Python is going to point to a local thing, a local executable called Python, and that's going to run all of the code. And as far as that local Python executable knows, everything that it has access to is located here in this environment directory. And so the idea is that you would install all of your Python modules locally into this directory. And because you're in the special environment mode, Python knows about those directories. It knows where to find those modules. It knows where to find them, and it runs your code perfectly happily. Now, if you leave that environment and try to execute your code, suddenly it doesn't know where the modules are, and it fails to run. What's the advantage to this? It seems like a real pain in the neck. Well, the advantage is that you're now not going to send your code to other people without being very certain that you are also sending them the correct modules. So you've self-contained everything, sort of forcing the developer to have an awareness of what's on their system. And of course, you've also empowered them to use a different version of a module than maybe they got on their system when they started up their computer, when they installed Linux or whatever. They got, I don't know, Pi Fu version 1, but in their latest code, what they really want to do is develop against Pi Fu version 2. And they can do that because they've got this environment that protects them from their outside, environment, their native environment, and provides them with this little minimalistic, bare bones, private environment into which they can put all the latest modules, and they can keep track of those modules, and then they can ship their code knowing exactly what they need to have accompanied with that code. Same idea here. You can create containers, you know exactly what's in the container, you know what you need to put into the container for the container to work, and so you have a greater awareness of what's actually going to have to run on your target systems. And you're also, of course, enabled to use whatever version of whatever library you need in order for your code to work correctly. So those are the potential advantages. There are stumbling blocks, and whether or not the benefits versus the costs are worth it is up to you, really, as a user. But I do think that it's significant and important to look at, because we don't know. This could be the way that we are headed. This could be a direction that Linux or the computers or the both are going in. And we should be aware of that. We should stay relevant. So let's take a look at Silverblue together. But first, let's go get some coffee. That'll be important. And we'll install, set up, and start using Fedora Silverblue 32. We're back. with coffee. Installing Silverblue is actually a little bit of an anti-climax. As long as you've installed Fedora or CentOS or RHEL before, the installation of Silverblue is exactly the same. In fact, it is so much the same, you will probably find yourself checking to make sure that you've actually downloaded Silverblue. That's what I did. I was going through the process, and I literally checked to make sure that I'd burned the correct image to my USB drive, because I thought, this just doesn't seem like it's different. This is really, really similar, and it is. It's very, very, it is the same. If you are used to the Anaconda Fedora installer, then you are familiar with how to install Silverblue. So once you've done that, you reboot and you go through a setup screen, which I think this part is actually also the new way that Fedora does things. The last time I installed Fedora, as I recall, I thought that setup stage was during the install phase. So I'm not sure if this has been moved out into its own thing for Silverblue, or whether that's just a new thing that Fedora is doing. I don't remember. But there's the setup stage, and I will say that the setup stage is a little bit weird, because during the install, if you choose a keyboard layout, such as Dvorak instead of QWERTY, then you will be surprised to find that that keyboard layout is not inherited for the setup stage. It defaults, as far as I can tell, to the US keyboard layout, QWERTY layout, for the setup. And the setup is really only about, I think, two things. It's you giving yourself a username and defining a password. There is no way that I could see to change, for instance, the UID or the group ID or anything like that. It seems very, very basic. You give it a name, you give it a password, that's all you get. There is a button for enterprise login, but as far as I could tell, that was something that was to hook your login into like an LDAP system or something. So I don't think that was what I wanted. So setting up, once you've done the setup, it drops you into the GNOME desktop, logged in as the user you've just created for yourself. And from here on out, your first experience with Silverblue, having been exactly the same for the install, similar or the same for the setup, your first experience with the Silverblue desktop, once again, you'll kind of be checking to make sure you're actually running Silverblue. It is exactly the same. It's a little bit more minimal than, for instance, the desktop of standard Fedora workstation. I couldn't find a whole lot of applications pre-installed. So yeah, I think, in fact, there was Firefox and a text editor and a terminal, a file manager. But that's really it. Like, there's really not a whole lot there. No LibreOffice, no, GIMP or whatever else distributions come with pre-installed these days. So that was a little bit surprising. But on the surface, like, if you're just clicking around and thinking, okay, now let me see the new exciting Silverblue stuff, you're not going to see it. It's exactly the same as what you would get from Fedora or CentOS. It's just an operating system. It's Linux with a GNOME desktop. So if that's all you ever saw of Silverblue, you might be underwhelmed. And by the way, if you've defined a different keyboard, it ignored it for the setup. Once you get into the GNOME desktop, that keyboard is loaded as your default keyboard, and you're good to go from there. So it was just for the setup, strangely, that it just sort of throws out your keyboard preference. Everything else completely respects that choice. Okay, so once you've logged in, you're looking around, you're not seeing anything different. Migrating data, let's talk about that for a moment, because if you're like me, you have at least some data to carry over to this new install. Now, this isn't my primary install. I have not switched to Silverblue as my full-time operating system. This is an experiment and little more. It's an enjoyable experiment, but this is not, I'm not taking my real home partition or anything and converting it into Silverblue. And I do say converting, because there are some important differences. So if you kind of poke around, you'll notice that home/home is not /home. /home is a symlink to /var/home. Not that big of a deal, really. Symlinks are pretty flexible on Linux. It's not, we can do this. You may have used a system where home isn't /home, where it's buried somewhere else. That's not completely uncommon. So seeing that it's been moved to /var/home/cla2 or whatever, it's not that surprising or scary. What is interesting, though, is that some of the paths become a little bit convoluted once you introduce some of these abstractions that you're going to be dealing with in practice. And I guess in order to talk about these abstractions, we need to kind of skip past what I'm talking about now and getting into how software is installed. So take it on faith that slash home and slash bin and slash opt, these are not real places, they're symlinks. So home is in var, opt is in var, bin is just pointing to user bin, sbin is pointing to user sbin. Little things like that, generally speaking, not a big deal, but there are path differences. Be aware of that. Now we'll move on to installing software. There are two ways on Silverblue that you're expected to install software, and really there's only one way, but actually there are three ways. If that sounds confusing, it's because it is. The lines that they draw in the sand are not super clear, I have found. Here's the theory. For most everything that you intend to use on Silverblue, you are expected to install it as a Flatpak. So if you open up GNOME Software, that's the name of the application, it's called Software. You open that up, you'll see that there are some applications available. Exciting things like GNOME Calculator, GNOME Calendar, little things like that. Not a whole lot, to be honest. And it turns out that, for instance, if I click on GNOME Calculator here, it tells me that it is a Flatpak. Now, if you've ever used GNOME Software on another distribution, or just on Fedora Standard, you'll know that it handles both RPMs and Flatpak. So this can be a little bit disorienting because now you're looking at something and you're not too sure whether this is an RPM or a Flatpak. By default on Silverblue, you only get Flatpaks. That's what you're seeing listed here. So the GNOME calculator says that it is version 3.3.8.1. It's a free license. And the source of this is registry.fedoraproject.org. And if I click around elsewhere on the interface, I can get a little bit more information, and it confirms that the format of this package is a Flatpak. So if I were to install that, it looks like it's already installed. So if I were to install that, then I would be installing this application as a Flatpak, which means that if I click on my activities or hit my penguin key and then type in calculator, it launches it. I'm using a Flatpak right now. This is a GUI Flatpak application. We know sort of how those are packaged and how those are distributed, and those rely upon the different Flatpak SDK layers or whatever they're called. That's fine. It works as expected. The selection of software in GNOME Software, the selection of applications in GNOME Software is rather limited because it's pointing to exactly one place, and that is registry. fedoraproject.org. So they have a limited selection of packages of Flatpaks that they have on offer currently. I mean, I'm sure that they're adding every day to that selection, but it is pretty limited right now. And in the documentation for Silverblue, they recommend pretty much right away that you install or that you provide support for FlatHub. FlatHub being sort of the premier generic vendor neutral, whatever term you want to use, repository for Flatpaks to the general public. You can post an application of Flatpak on FlatHub. People can download your Flatpak ref and install it on their system. So in order to get to there on Silverblue, you have to tell GNOME Software where to look, how to get that FlatHub repository, how to add that FlatHub repository to its configuration. It's pretty simple. The instructions are right on flathub.org. It's under the quick setup. It tells you how to set it up on Fedora. And as it turns out, that's the exact process that you use on Silverblue. No exceptions there. It's all through Flatpak itself. So this is not, you're not downloading an RPM and adding a repository. You're downloading a Flatpak ref, a reference file to Flathub, and installing and making it available to GNOME Software and a Flatpak indeed underneath that layer, underneath the application. You know, it's being used by GNOME Software. You don't have to do it through the GUI. You can do it in your terminal just as you would normally. It's, I think the command is something like, I don't know, Flatpak remote add flathub.flatpakref or something like that. Don't type that in because I'm wrong, but It's something like that. So once you do that, then Flatpak is aware that this repository exists out there on the internet, and now you can do things like Flatpak and install Flathub or .gnome or .gimp, for instance, and that will pull the GIMP application from Flathub repository and install it on your system. Unless I got the command wrong, I'm rattling them off the top of my head, and the Flatpak commands are by no means simple. They are overcomplex, verbose, and awkward. But that's the way that you would do that. It works well enough. One issue that I had when doing this, I attempted to do it as much by the docs as possible the first time I did this. And so I went to GNOME Software, I added the repository, and GNOME Software is just eerily, eerily quiet. It does not tell you what's going on. I don't know why they're doing this, but there's no status bar, there's no animation for working, you know, there's no spinning wheel, there's no blinking dots, nothing. So I do the process and it just sits there, and I think it's crashed because that's what it looks like has happened. It's a blank white screen with no indication that it is processing my request. Eventually I gave up on that and I started doing things just in the terminal. And eventually, through a series of trial and error, I was copying a bunch of data from a backup drive onto the Silverblue system. And so I let that go overnight, and when I got up in the morning to check on things, I discovered that not only had all my data copied over successfully, but also GNOME Software had caught up to all of the data it was pulling from the repository, and now it was acting normal. It was acting like an application ought to act. It just wasn't giving me any indication that that's what it was doing, so that was a little bit unsettling. And to this day, I find GNOME Software a little bit unsettling in the same way. Like, I'll ask it to do something, and instead of sort of like giving me an indication that it is processing my request in any way, it just shows me a blank screen. It's unnerving. I don't know why that's the direction that goes in. I don't know if that's a conscious choice or if they just haven't gotten around to implementing a working animation. And I'm the guy who hates working animations. I think they're silly, but just some kind of indication that yes, the process, the request has been received and we're working on it. Okay, so that's GNOME Software. You add a Flatpak repository, then you're able to install Flatpaks from both Flathub and registry.fedoraproject.org. And that's what they expect you to do. And I will admit, there are more Flatpaks out there than you might think. I mean, for instance, I certainly think of Flatpaks as GUI applications. I mean, you definitely don't want to try to use a Flatpak from a terminal. That's a miserable experience. You do not want to have to go through that. That's horrible. And that's what Flatpak says, and they have stated that several times. I don't agree with that decision, but that is what that's what they've said, that they are not aiming for the terminal as a target. They are aiming for graphical applications. Love it or hate it, that's what their mission, their stated mission is. So if you look at GNOME Software and you're searching around, you do find things that I found surprising. For instance, there are fonts that are distributed as Flatpaks, which I didn't know they were. See, right there, I just now typed in font, and for a whole sentence, it was just a white screen. And once again, I thought, okay, well, I guess it's crashed, or I've entered a bad query, I need to change it. It's so silent during those moments. I don't know. Nope, now it's scrolling. man. Bitstream, Deja Vu, you know all these fonts. These are familiar to you if you've ever used Linux. Yeah, fonts. Distributed as Flatpaks. I didn't know that fonts could be distributed as Flatpaks. So that was interesting. There's other stuff too. Tweak, GNOME Tweaks. That's here, eventually, maybe. Yep, there it is. Okay, yep, GNOME Tweaks, and you can install that, and then you can change your GNOME settings beyond what GNOME settings provides, and so on. So that is the intended primary install method of software. It is through the Flatpak system. Now, along with that comes a couple of surprises that you may not expect. For instance, let's say you're running Foo, and Foo expects your software to be in home.local.share.foo, /share/foo. That's a fairly common setup. That's what the .local folder is for. It is the standardized location for .configuration files. Well, not for .config. That would be in .config. Okay, so it's somewhat standardized location for these generally scattered hidden folders that used to clutter up your Linux home directory. Put them all in .local/share, and it kind of mirrors /user/share, and it's a standardized place for them all to go, and it's kind of neater and a little bit more consolidated. It's good stuff. Problem is that Flatpaks want data to exist in a Flatpak-related directory. And so the answer to that is to put things in a .var folder in your home directory, and then point that Flatpak to that .var directory in your home. So you've got, for instance, paths that used to be /home/clat2/.local/share/foo, and now they look like this: /var/home/clat2/.var/app/org.example.foo/.local/share/foo. That is a really long, really ugly, really convoluted path, and that you will see that. You will see that in some applications. You will install something in Flatpak as a Flatpak. It will expect to find data in var, but because it's personalized data, it needs to be in your home, so it goes into .var. And because it's a Flatpak, everything is under this /app/unique identifier. And then because it's supposed to be in your home, it has its inherited default path structure of .local/share/name of application. So migrating your data can be a little bit of a chore, because now you're putting things not into a consolidated.local file in your home directory. You're putting it into a consolidated.var that is then broken out into application-specific subdirectories. Have fun with that. Okay, that's the default software install method, and apparently the data migration path for Silverblue and for Flatpak. That doesn't always work, though, because let's say that you needed a special graphics driver, and I do use the NVIDIA drivers on my systems because I paid a pretty good amount of money for my graphics cards. Not all the time. It depends on the use case of that particular bootable system. Unfortunately, NVIDIA does not make those drivers, or rather the specifications, the details of their graphics processors available to people. But for Fedora Silverblue, I figured, why not? Let's learn how to install an NVIDIA driver on an immutable OS image. It's not that hard, it's just another way to install software that is discouraged. They acknowledge that sometimes this is necessary, however, so it's something that you can do, you just shouldn't do too often. How often is too often? And they don't exactly say. That can be a little bit difficult to comprehend. I didn't find that super easy to quite understand, like, the limitations. Because they say, oh, you can install RPMs with rpm-ostree. It's a special command that leverages both the RPM system and, of course, the OS tree model of structuring things. But I don't know how often I'm supposed to do that. How is it just for the really, really important stuff? Or just the stuff that's literally impossible to install by some other means? And remember, there is this third way of installing software that we'll get to in a little while. But how am I meant to sort of manage what I install to the base image versus somewhere else? They don't have great guidance on that, and I'm assuming that it probably is a little bit fuzzy. Like, NVIDIA drivers, okay, literally no other way to do that. Like, that needs to be a part of the bootable system. It's a kernel level type, it's a kernel level thing, so it needs to be there at boot time. I get that, so that's a necessity. But what about Emacs? Emacs doesn't need to be there at boot, but it is something that I definitely want all the time throughout my entire environment. So could I put that as part of the host, the immutable system? Or should that not be done? Should I only install that as some kind of extra package? And there is a Flatpak for Emacs, but as I've said before, running a Flatpak in a terminal is a miserable experience. It doesn't really work all that well, to be honest. You can do it, it's just not fun. So am I meant to just get over that and install it as a Flatpak anyway, or am I allowed to kind of deviate from the expectation and install it to my host system? Who knows? I don't know. For NVIDIA anyway, for a driver, for something that needs to be there at boot time, there's a relatively easy way to install that. It is, as I said, rpm-ostree. This is a lot less complex than I kind of had expected. It really is. It's just think DNF, except instead of DNF, you're using rpm-ostree to kind of poke your way through to that host system. So for instance, using NVIDIA as the example, because that's the one example I actually have, rpm-os tree install, and then the path to the rpmfusion.org repository. This is the exact same thing that you find on rpmfusion.org when looking into how to set up configure it for your system. So there's a configure button at the top, configure link, top of the webpage. Click that, it tells you the command to run. The only difference to what it tells you to do is it is telling you to run DNF, and so you use instead rpm-os tree. Otherwise, it's the exact same everything. That installs the correct repository, or it adds that repository to your host system. However, remember, OS tree told us it can't change the operating system. There's no way to change this thing. It is immutable. So in order for that to take effect, you must reboot. And so you do a systemctl reboot, the system reboots, it loads, you're back up and running. Now you've got that repository existing on your host system. And so then you can do an install of whatever kernel module you need. So in this case, it would be rpm-os tree install, acmod-nvidia, and whatever the NVIDIA driver for X11 is, acmod NVIDIA Zorg X11 DRV NVIDIA, whatever it's called. I think that's it. I didn't do that from memory. I'm frantically scanning the screen for information. So you do that, and once again, you have to remember, this can't take effect until you reboot, but if you've ever had to do the NVIDIA install, you'll also know that you can't reboot without blacklisting Nuvo. So you have to tell your system not to load the free open source driver Nuvo and instead load the NVIDIA driver. Now it's interesting, and I don't quite understand why this is an RPM OS tree command. Seems like it ought to just be an OS tree command, but for whatever reason there is a hook in RPM-OS tree that enables you to modify the kernel arguments that your computer processes while loading the Linux kernel at boot time. So if you've ever gone to your bootloader in Linux, or before Linux is booted, you know, the grub bootloader, then you know that if you hit E, you can see what kind of weird commands your computer is broadcasting to the kernel when it starts bootstrapping your system. Those are kernel arguments, and you can change that with rpm-os tree. So before rebooting, you can run rpm-os tree kargs, that's K-A-R-G-S, and then you can append the necessary information. So again, for NVIDIA, I'm just looking really quick through my history here. It was rpm-os tree kargs space dash dash append equals rd.driver.blacklist equals nuvo dash dash append equals NVIDIA dash DR in dot mode set equals one and dash dash append equals modprobe dot blacklist equals nuvo. So you're appending these new parameters to the boot environment or to the boot command, basically telling it to ignore the nuvo driver and to load NVIDIA instead. Again, systemctl reboot reimages everything and makes that the active branch of your operating system. It works like a charm. It reboots, it's an uglier boot process, it uses the NVIDIA driver. And then once you're up and running, you can do an lsmod just as you normally would in a terminal to verify that the correct driver has been loaded. Just do it right now, just to kind of confirm. I'm doing an lsmod grep dash I because I can't ever remember. I think it's all lowercase. Yeah, NVIDIA. And the same command looking for nuvo should, of course, fail, and it does. Or it doesn't fail, it returns nothing. So there you go. That's the second way to install software. And they discourage this. They say, you shouldn't do this. This is messing with your immutable operating system. Don't do this. Obviously, you have to sometimes for NVIDIA especially, or for anything that would load at boot time. You would have to do that. For everything else, they're telling you that you should either use Flatpak or something called Toolbox. And Toolbox, in my opinion, is the other place that this gets. But actually, all three of these things are interesting. So Toolbox, I guess, is the most maybe interactive part of this whole experience. Flatpaks are interesting, but they luckily, they're kind of really easy to do now. You install it from GNOME software, and they just run. They're just applications. And I have to say that these Flatpaks are running really, really nicely on this Silverblue system to a degree. So there's a caveat here. First of all, I will say that on Slackware, when I installed, I had tried an Audacity Flatpak on Slackware. It was working okay, but I had this weird issue at first where it wouldn't recognize my USB microphone. I realized that for some reason, the Flatpak, the Audacity instance running, you know, sort of inside the Flatpak environment, couldn't find my USB port. And so I had to give it permission to access my devices or something like that. I forget the exact flag, but it was like dash dash portal or dash dash devices or something like that, where I granted it extra permission on top of what it thought it could do. And then it worked. It was fine. It just needed, every time I launched it, I had to do Flatpak run dash dash, you know, whatever special flag it was, or dot Audacity team or team Audacity dot Audacity, but with a capital A. And it was fine. I didn't actually stick with it. That was too much trouble. So I just went back to a normal installed compiled version of it. But that happened. On Silverblue, none of that happened. I installed Audacity, which I'm recording this episode on right now, as proof of concept. You're welcome. And it saw my USB microphone. It's running fine. I say fine, but I'm actually seeing some weird performance issues. There are, like, it seems to lose track of my audio sometimes. It sort of stalls. I can't tell. It hasn't crashed because I'll stop recording. I'll back up. I'm not sure if it's just the graphics aren't keeping up, which would be weird, or if something else is happening. It's difficult to understand what exactly the problem is. I mean, this is the same physical computer as my Slackware install. My Slackware install exists on another drive in the same box, so I tend to know the way that it performs pretty well. Okay, so you can't tell, but I've had to stop the recording and re-pick up what I was saying because it stalled. So it's definitely an issue that seems to be happening every now and again, and it shouldn't be happening at all. It doesn't happen on Slackware. It doesn't happen on RHEL. It's only happening on this specific thing. I don't know if it's like the drive. I don't know if it's the OS. I'm not sure what's happening. And I probably would have just chalked it up to, I don't know, general Audacity weirdness or something. But there have been other weird little things, like when I go to a terminal and do an LS, and then I do a control P for previous command. Well, of course it worked just then, but sometimes when I do control P, it seems to hang almost, and I can't sort of get out of whatever loop it's gotten into. And so then I'll hit the up arrow, and then it cycles through my commands like I would expect. But yeah, there are little tiny little glitches here and there that I can't quite pin down. I don't know if it's Silverblue. If it's some kind of, you know, layer on top of my desktop that's sort of slowing things down, or what exactly is going on, but it's definitely something that I have noticed and has affected the way that I work. Okay, so that aside, everything is working quite smoothly, and I don't want to brush past that too much. I mean, that aside, it's still affected the way that I work, but I'm not sure what the cause is there, so I don't want to judge it too harshly until I, you know, I would want to do more experiments, maybe on a different computer, different setup, just kind of see what else, see if there are other factors at play here that I'm not thinking of. So anyway, the other way to install software then is what's called Toolbox, and it is a mutable interactive container environment. So it really is, going back to that Python environment analogy, it's a lot like that. The way that you do this is you do Toolbox. Well, you open a terminal, first of all. So actually, slow down here. We're Linux users. We're all friends. We use the terminal a lot. We like the terminal. And so you might want to do something like, I don't know, here I'm in my host system, so I'll do a git facl of this file, examples.desktop. It looks like the owner is Clatu, the group is Clatu, the user rw, group r, other r. Okay, standard stuff, not a big deal. It's not what I normally expect to see really on my system, because I always assign Clatu as owner and the group is always users. But on Silverblue, it's Clatu and Clatu, because by default that's what it creates. That's a whole other thing that we'll get into in a little while. So Toolbox is a command in your terminal, and you can do Toolbox help to kind of get a feel for what it's all about. Itself, it describes itself as it's a tool that offers a familiar RPM-based environment for developing and debugging software that runs fully unprivileged using Podman. The Toolbox container is a fully mutable container. When you see yum install Ansible, for example, that's something you can do inside your Toolbox container without affecting the base operating system, okay? So Toolbox is, by its own declaration, really just a way for you to do normal normal Linux things, which is a little bit upsetting, right? That feels a little bit weird. Wait, I need a special command so that I can create a special environment on my operating system so that I can use it like I normally use my operating system. It feels weird. And indeed, it has some quirks. It is a little bit weird, but it's also really fun. So we'll do toolbox create. That's the first thing that you do. And it pulls down what I can only assume is a minimal image of Fedora Linux. It's about 500 megabytes, so half a gig to get normal terminal functionality on your Fedora Linux OS. Doesn't take too long, even on my slow internet connection, so that's nice. And then you can enter your toolbox. So this is very much like NSEnter. Toolbox, enter. And now we are in the toolbox, and we know that we're in the toolbox because it says Clacksu at toolbox. That's my prompt now, so that makes it relatively obvious as to where we are. And in this toolbox, this is an environment, and you can, as I said, you can run DNF commands just as you normally expect. So I could say DNF search. Let's do a DNF search ffmpeg just for fun. And we'll let that cycle through its repositories really quick. Of course, it's Fedora, so it likes to update, you know, get the most up-to-date listing of available software. And I'm doing this because you and I know that I added the rpmfusion.org repository to the host system. So in theory, when I'm searching for something crazy like ffmpeg, there should be an entry for that in rpmfusion. But in reality, you would notice that if you did this, or if you could see my screen, it doesn't check rpmfusion. That's because we're in a toolbox. It's a minimal environment. And as far as this toolbox realized, knows that it doesn't have RPM fusion. Is that weird? Yeah, it's really weird, especially since in this toolbox, I can do an ls and see all of the data in my home directory. So it is very confusing if you're not aware that what may look like an overlay to you is more like it's more like a cheroot, I guess. We have changed we've changed what our root directory is away from /ostree, maybe. I don't really know the technical details behind it. I haven't looked into it, but we're changing our root away from what we think it would be, you know, /user/bin/whatever, to something different. So our new /user/bin/whatever is a completely different location. And that includes, of course, /etc. So if I do a ls on /etc/yum/repos.d, you see indeed that the only repositories in there are Fedora repositories, no RPM fusions. I can add it here. I can add RPM fusion inside my toolbox. Just take note, I've now done that twice. If I do, for instance, a cat on /etc/, no, actually, let's save that for a moment later. So we'll do an ls on /user/bin. Actually, we'll take the shortcut. We'll just say which git facl says, I installed it. I'm going to pretend you can't see it anyway. It says command not found. No git facl found in user bin local or user local bin, user local sbin, bin, sbin, user bin, or user sbin. That's because git facl wasn't part of this minimal install, this minimal image that we pulled down when we were creating the toolbox. But we know when we were, I'm going to type in exit and do a which git facl, and it of course knows where git facl is, user bin git facl. So now I will go back into my toolbox, toolbox enter, and do a sudo dnf install -y, so I don't have to confirm it, acl. That would provide git facl and set facl. So do that, I'm pretending. Then it installs it, because I've already done this in real life, and then I can use git facl, I can do a which git facl, and it'll show me it's in user bin, but it is not the same git facl that I've used on my host system. It is the one that I installed, or that I, you could say, reinstalled into my toolbox container. Okay, so that's the weird side of toolbox. The cool side of toolbox is that you can do dnf install. You can just do sudo dnf install whatever you want. So ImageMagick, sure, we've got that, we can install that. I don't know, whatever else people install on Linux. Any number of commands, coreutils, that's already there. Parallel, that's a good one, that's always fun to have. All that stuff will install into your toolbox, and you'll have full use of those commands within your toolbox. If you type in the word exit while at a toolbox prompt, however, you're out of your toolbox, you're back to your host, and if you do something like convert command not found, parallel command not found, and so on. So toolbox is a container. It is a place that you have to go to find those commands. Outside of the container, those commands do not exist. They're not on your host system. Your host system is immutable, so it's not there. This can be really, really jarring because you'll want to use a command in one place and then you'll realize, oh, I need to go back into my toolbox in order for that to work. Now, you still have access to all of your local data, so in practice, for the most part, it won't matter. But it does get a little bit weird when you're talking about groups and users. So for instance, if I type in groups in my host system terminal, I get Klaatu and wheel. Those are the two groups that I exist in. And in fact, if I do a cat etsy group, I see that there are strangely three groups on my system, root, wheel, and Klaatu. That's it. If I go into my toolbox though, you probably see where this is going, and then type in cat/etsy/groups, and group, singular, then there's a full list here, just like you would expect on a Linux system. You see things like users, and nobody, and TCP dump, and so on. All the usual groups that you would expect. And indeed, if I type in the word groups, I see that I am a member of users inside of my toolbox, but not outside of my toolbox. Outside of my toolbox, I'm just a member of Klaatu and Wheel. That can be troubling if you've got a lot of external media that you're having to juggle around group and user permissions, which I do. I tend to use get and set facl a lot more than I do chown and things like that. So this has really disrupted my workflow. I don't know how common that really is in practice. I don't know how big of a deal it would be for most people. I think a lot of people, especially if you're standardizing your systems, I think maybe it wouldn't be that big of a deal. I will say that my work login is different than my personal login. So even though my work computer is Red Hat Enterprise Linux 8 and my a personal system now is a Silverblue, those ought to have been sort of, those should feel standard, but they're not, because the work login assigned to me is not a work login, or is not a login that I normally use, and I'm certainly not going to change my entire sort of computing mentality just because my work login arbitrarily assigned me this login instead of that login. So that does disrupt my workflow. The fact that there's no generic users group and there's a very specific group that mirrors your username, that throws off my entire scheme for external media or external devices, like USB drives and stuff. So that's a bother, and I'm going to have to figure out how to get the users group over into my host system. Now, apparently, from what I understand, /etsy is not managed by OS tree. It is something that is kind of, it's not in the OS tree directory, right? It's out there. It actually is in slash, it is slash etsy. It's not slash var, slash etsy, or whatever. It's just slash etsy. So from what I understand, it's okay to edit /etsy/group, put users in there, and then I guess probably reboot or something, or maybe just log out, who knows, like traditional style, and then I should be in the users group and it should all be fine. I've been meaning to do that for weeks now and I just haven't gotten around to it. But the thing to remember here really is that the Silverblue experience, and this sounds like a mean thing to say, but the true Silverblue experience are the small failings here and there that you don't expect. You know, like it's the big stuff and it works beautifully. And you'll never even know you're on Silverblue. And that's really cool. You'll know that you're on Silverblue with Toolbox. And I can't quite decide whether, I guess that is not a failing. So Toolbox, I think, especially if you just kind of start using some Ansible playbooks and you start spinning up toolboxes and you trigger an Ansible playbook to set up your environment, you're basically treating this like really a Python environment or a container where you get the base image and then you automate the process that makes that image look like what you actually want it to look like to get started with. On a slow internet connection, is that problematic? Yeah, that can be problematic. It's not a fast thing when you're on an ADSL line like I am out in the middle of nowhere. So it's something. It's something to be aware of. It's something to think about. It is not maybe as low-tech and autonomous as one might want it to be, but it is a tool that exists. It's fun to play around with. It's kind of an interesting take on managing user environments, and that's kind of interesting. And I would say that the idea of being able to separate sort of like those boring administrative, this is what it takes to keep your computer running, versus this is all the stuff that you're doing on top of your computer. That has always intrigued me, and I've always thought that maybe we should have like almost separate processors for those two things, so that some bulk of some physical processors could just be running the system, and then others could be running the applications on top of it. That idea has always intrigued me. None of which is happening here. I'm just saying it's an interesting concept to separate so severely system from user sort of environments and processes. And that's kind of what Silverblue is doing. It's very interesting to experience. It is something I think you ought to try. I don't know that you ought to switch to it for good. I don't know that it's wise to sit down and say, okay, next install, Silverblue. That's all I'm doing. It's just going to be Silverblue. Think about that before you do that. That's a big step, and I don't know that it's the immediate right step. It may be. I'm just saying you should think about it. There will be differences to that user experience that you won't expect. And then strangely, and this is what's tricky about it, at other times there will be no difference at all, and you will insist that you're not on Silverblue. You will think, I must have done something wrong, I got confused, I didn't install Silverblue, I just installed Fedora. But you haven't. You are actually on Silverblue. And the moments that you will notice that, I think, are when you're trying to do stuff in a terminal, because that'll take some getting used to. And when you're installing something that normally would be really, really easy to install via an RPM, now you realize you're supposed to be installing it through Flatpak, but it's not available through Flatpak. And so how do you integrate what you've installed in your toolbox to the rest of your system? And so, for instance, as an experiment, I installed X-Eyes. It's a pair of eyes that appears on your screen and follows your mouse cursor. It's a silly little program, but it's something that I use very frequently just to kind of test various things. So X-Eyes I installed. Had to install it in a toolbox because it's not available as a Flatpak. So I dropped into my toolbox, did a sudo dnf install xeyes, and then pressed my activity button, my activities menu on my system, I typed in xey, there's nothing there, xeyes, nothing. So it's not available to my host system. GNOME does not, in other words, know about xeyes. But if I type in xeyes in my toolbox, then it launches and it appears on my desktop. So that means XEyes only exists within my toolbox. It is usable, it's integrated as such because it does launch and it works on my system, but there's that degree of separation. And I guess if I took the XEyes launcher, which should exist in /user/share/applications XEyes, and it doesn't seem to, so maybe it's in ls.local/share/applications/XEyes. It does not exist there either. So these are good reasons it wouldn't show up, I guess, in my activities menu. But you're getting my point, that there are things that I feel we would normally expect on a Linux system, and there's this kind of weird disconnect between the terminal and the graphical environment. And that's starting to feel a little bit uncomfortably like the terminal experience on macOS. If you've ever had the displeasure of trying to use the Unix part of your Mac system, this feels, like I say, uncomfortably similar, because it is a miserable experience. It's not fun. There's this awkward separation between the two that slows you down more than anything. And so I'm hoping that there's a little bit more done to integrate the toolbox environment with the rest of the system, at least in some way. I mean, maybe even if there was just a default toolbox where you're managing your system sort of, and that would be your default one, and then for the developers who need to spin up those containers, then there are the normal toolboxes, like the disposable ones, the ones that you do for your different container projects or whatever. But not having that absolute connection between the things that I'm doing in my toolbox and the system that I want to run, that doesn't feel very Linux-y to me, and it feels like a big, big step back. Like I say, there are advantages and there are costs, and whether one or the other outweighs one or the other is that it's up to you. It's entirely a matter of interpretation. We're still very early on in Silver Blue life cycle. I don't remember when exactly it came out. It's probably been a year or two now by now, but it's still pretty early, is my point. There's a lot happening with containers. There's a lot happening with Silver Blue. There's always a lot happening with Fedora. So who knows where we're headed? This is all unlike the core OS. This is all mutable. This could change drastically by this time next year. Who knows? All I'm saying is it's an interesting experiment. You should try it out. If you're getting bored with knowing too much about Linux, go over to Silver Blue. Try to figure some stuff out. It'll be a new puzzle for you. It's really interesting stuff. If nothing else, it's an interesting experiment. So get involved. Get into it. See if you enjoy it. See if you hate it. I don't know. I guess if you want to email me, let me know what you think. It's fun. It's interesting. This is open source. This is the reason that we love this stuff. It is open source. We are in at the beginning. We're on the ground level right here. If you want to get involved, you can. If you want to try it, you can. If you want to ignore it, you're more than welcome to do that as well. That's the beauty of this. Thanks for going along on this with me. Next week, we will continue with the Slackware packages. We're somewhere in the N section, N as in November. Same place, same time. Thanks for listening. Talk to you then. Thank you for listening to the GNU World Order Augcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time. I'm